Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. Always grateful to you for that. Lots to do on the program today. We're going to be talking a little bit about the U.S. farm sector and the looming trade war with China, and a little bit about how the opioid epidemic, as it persists here in the U.S., how that in particular is looking with workers who are overdosing on the job. Really important stuff that we will be getting into a little bit later in the program. Right now, we're joined by Lauren Zumbach, writer at Chicago Tribune, who wrote about a couple of law changes that will require online retailers to collect more sales tax from people in Illinois. But, you know, this story is not as straightforward, perhaps, as it seems. Lauren, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Amy.
So break this down, if you would, because there's a couple of timeline things that don't quite appear to make a lot of sense, I think, at first glance. And that is that two bills introduced in the U.S. House would, you know, like, changes the timeline of this, and yet this is set to begin Monday. So I feel like there's a lot of people kind of scrambling for information, particularly shoppers and retailers, really kind of curious how this is going to impact them.
Right. Well, you're right. Two bills were introduced in Congress, but just earlier this month. And both of those would sort of give retailers a little bit of an extension to, begin complying with laws like the one in Illinois that would require more of them to start collecting sales tax. But, you know, Illinois is not alone in, having laws that are set to take effect sooner. Neither of the bills currently in Congress has been called to a vote, so I'd say that's pretty unlikely to happen before things go into effect on Monday. So some of that's still up in the air. You know, those bills also include some other proposals that would try to make it easier for small businesses in particular to comply with the new requirements around collecting taxes. So what happens to those is still up in the air. But, for now, Illinois' law is set to take effect on Monday.
Right. And probably not any kind of vote happening between now and then for that extension for retailers. And so which online retailers will have to start adding sales tax for Illinois shoppers?
Right. So depending on where you're shopping, you might actually not notice too much of a difference. Basically, before, only retailers with a physical presence in the state had to collect sales tax when you were shopping online. So that could be a bricks and mortar store, or it could be, a distribution center or warehouse. So Amazon, for instance, so one of the biggest online retailers, has been charging sales tax since 2015 in Illinois because it has a lot of, warehouses and places where it's storing and shipping products here. So the retailers that are where you might see it that, didn't have to charge it before would be those that don't have any sort of facilities in Illinois but do enough business in the state that they either, make more than 200 sales to Illinois shoppers or more than $100,000 in total sales in a year. Some of those, actually one retailer that's already started is Overstock.com. They sell furniture and didn't have any presence in the state up till this point and still don't, but, basically after a Supreme Court decision back in June that opened the door for states like Illinois to expand collection, said that they were just going to start doing it pretty much across the country, everywhere that had a sales tax law. They're one of the new ones that's already come on board. You also might notice it more at marketplace sites. For instance, eBay or Etsy or Amazon, where third-party sellers are posting their products and just using that platform to reach shoppers all over the country. If it's a merchant who does enough business in Illinois, that they would hit those minimum thresholds, you might have to start paying there as well.
I was just about to ask you about something like Etsy or Amazon third-party sellers, how that would work. I'm glad you mentioned that. In particular, Etsy, it seems like for Etsy sellers, I think a ton of people have like an Etsy shop with some kind of side hustle going on, right? But
right.
So it seems like you would have to be doing a pretty significant level of business for that to impact you as a seller.
Right, right. And they were actually, one of the companies that had opposed some of the new legislation around this and opposed expanding the requirements, basically saying that, especially for some of those smaller businesses, it is difficult to keep track of sales tax laws all over the country. And, some of those smaller retailers might have a harder time complying with the new rules.
And so when we look at what the state and what the state is, I'm sure, looking at, and that is the bottom line, what kind of revenue is the state anticipating from this move?
So the state of Illinois has estimated that they would bring in about $200 million more dollars a year in sales tax through this. Now, I should say that this isn't a new tax. Illinois consumers were already supposed to be paying sales tax, even if the retailer didn't collect it. There is a box on your Illinois tax forms where we're supposed to report that. But a lot of the experts I spoke to said that, they were pretty confident that the state wasn't collecting everything that it might have felt entitled to.
Right. And did you get the sense in working on this story in your reporting that some online retailers are feeling like this might make a dent in their overhead and cut into revenue?
I think that would depend a lot on the type of business that you're talking to. So, for instance, Overstock, the retailer that, said that they were going to start collecting sales tax, pretty much across the board, back in June, they said that they didn't really notice an impact on sales because they, they said that while there was, some extra work that they had to do to comply with their requirements, once you started having to collect in, the first couple outside states, it wasn't as difficult to add more. And, they also made the case that, back when online shopping was relatively new, people really were looking at it as a way to find, the lowest possible price. But now they see people shopping online more for convenience, and maybe people aren't, as concerned about, trying to save those couple extra dollars in sales tax.
Sure.
But, you could see maybe a smaller business like that, person with their side hustle on Etsy, maybe finding some of the overhead to be a little more costly.
Certainly. Well, we'll keep turning to you for the latest after this, I'm sure. It looks like all signs are pointing to yes. It goes into effect on Monday. Lauren Zimbach, writer at Chicago Tribune, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Have a good one. All right, we're going to take a little break and come back. And when we return, we are going to be talking a little bit about the U.S. farm sector and what it might look like as we start looking ahead to trade concerns with China. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots to talk about on the program. Still a little bit later after news, we're going to be talking about the opioid epidemic and how that crisis looks in the workplace, and in particular with workers and employers, and how they are discussing that topic. Right now, we're joined by Jacob Bungee, agriculture reporter at Wall Street Journal, who recently wrote about how the U.S. farm sector is bracing for a trade war with China, which is already beginning to take a toll on some farmers now. Jacob, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
I'm fine.
Great. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today. So talk us through this story. I think we've all heard so much about trade in this last year that I think there's probably a little bit of just kind of confusion and fatigue going on about this story. But when it comes to farmers, especially here in the Midwest, I think there's a lot of great concern going and already some of those effects starting to be felt. Break that down for us, if you would.
So the pain, if you will, is economic in nature for farmers. As you say, the effects that the folks that are raising soybeans and hogs and other crops, the effect that they're feeling is one of immediately lower prices. And the reason for that is because China is such a big purchaser of U.S. agricultural commodities. You know, they've got over a billion consumers there. They're the biggest pork-consuming nation in the world, the biggest pork-producing country in the world. But their appetite is such that they require just tremendous amounts of crops to turn into feed for their livestock sector and additional foodstuffs. They buy a lot of dairy products from the United States. They buy still a lot of pork from us. And so when they confront something like their government raising up the price to import some of these products from the United States, the importers over there turn to other sources. They've begun buying soybeans from places like Brazil and from Argentina. They've begun buying more pork from places like Germany and Spain and Chile even. And the result is that prices go down here, and the farmers are the ones that feel that most directly. And so to give you some ideas, since the trade dispute really began flaring with China in June or so, the price of soybeans have dropped by about $2 per bushel. That's around one-fifth. The hog farmers are looking right now at losses of around $40 per pig, and that really adds up when you consider the fact that some of these farmers will raise thousands and thousands of hogs.
Certainly. And so when we're looking at impacts that are already starting and then looking ahead to, you know, I'm sure farmers are trying to stay a step ahead of it and say, okay, what's coming next and how can I get out ahead of that? What are we, you know, what are farmers anticipating as kind of the next piece of that as they're cutting prices and I'm sure making moves to try to, you know, lessen some of those impacts on their business?
Well, there's some things that farmers typically do that can provide some protection. One has been to sort of sell their crops in advance, and this is something that farmers do as a typical practice. And so some farmers have been able to, in the case of soybeans, for instance, already have sold some of the soybeans they are going to be harvesting right now and over the next month or so at higher prices. They were able to lock in better prices earlier in the year. But typically, farmers aren't going to do that for their entire crop because they just don't always know how much they're going to have. You know, there's a bad year. The summer is very dry, for instance. They don't want to sell more than they're going to produce. So it helps, but it's not going to be a full protection for most people. And another thing that farmers are able to do is just sort of bank their crops. You drive around in the countryside and you see these really tall and wide silver steel bins. And for a certain period of time, farmers can put some of their crops away in these and kind of wait for prices to improve, and maybe things will get sorted out with China here, and the prices will look better to them in a few months. But farmers also need to raise cash, because if you're in the business of farming and if you're raising crops, you're going to need to buy seeds and buy fertilizer and buy pesticides and things like that. All that's got to be done by the time you're able to get out in the field, you know, in April, say, or May, and get planting. So, you know, there's a clock that ticks on people when they consider what their options are here.
Right. And so right now, is there, you know, are there more moves on the horizon, or is it really just a wait and see for farmers right now?
Well, as far as the trade picture goes, you know, the farmers have been raising their voice. They say that, you know, by and large, they agree with President Trump that China may well not be playing fair on issues like intellectual property protections and technology transfer. But at the same time, they've got a livelihood to maintain. They're very worried that if China, you know, gets used to buying the bulk of its soybeans from South America, as the U.S. going to be able to come back, you know, when the tariffs are dropped at some point in time. It's kind of like if, you know, there's two grocery stores that you go to and they're about the same distance away, but all of a sudden you start having to pay $20 to park at one grocery store, and you know, you figure that's only temporary, and you start going to the other one, but you know, your routine becomes ingrained with going to the other grocery store. And if the parking becomes free again, you know, are you going to start going back? It's an open question. And so for that reason, you've seen a lot of the farm groups really raise this concern. They've been raising it with their senators, with the congressmen, and so on. But as of right now, it looks like the U.S. and China are bearing down for tougher talks as opposed to things going in a friendly direction.
That's right. That's right. Well, thank you so much. We'll continue to turn to you, Jacob Bungie, agriculture reporter at Wall Street Journal, as this continues to unfold and we see how this impacts farm workers here in the U.S. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Yep, sure thing.
All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Still lots to do here on the back half of the program. Up next, we're joined by Jenny Gold, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, who joins us by phone. Jenny wrote about how, as the opioid epidemic persists in the U.S., how employers are responding, or in some cases, not responding at all, to the growing problem of people overdosing on the job. Jenny, thank you so much for being with us today. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, as we talk about the opioid epidemic in the U.S., I think that's become such a common phrase that I don't know that we really, maybe we've kind of lost sight of the real size of it. So how big a crisis is it when we're really talking about this crisis?
Well, we know that 72,000 people died in 2017 from overdoses, and a large part of that was from opioid-related deaths. And it looks right now like much of that is due to synthetic opioids like fentanyl.
Right. And as you note in the story, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this out after the program, because it is a really interesting story with a lot of very interesting data points in it that I want you to read for yourselves.
Thank you.
But you note that a stunning 70% of employers reported that their businesses had been affected by prescription drug abuse in 2017. 70% is a very significant, that's most employers. And so
it is, but when you think about 2/3 of American adults who are misusing painkillers are part of the workforce, that's a lot. It's not like all of these people are sitting on the street shooting up heroin. I mean, these are our coworkers and our friends and our family members.
Certainly. And so in reporting this story, particularly focusing on workplace overdoses, which is such an interesting, you know, slice of this epidemic that I think is probably very under discussed. What was surprising to you about this story?
Well, we don't know a lot about the numbers on how many people are overdosing at work. What we know is that in 2016, there were 217 overdose deaths that the Bureau of Labor Statistics picked up on. That's just the tip of the iceberg. First of all, it's probably an undercount. And second, those are just people who actually died. What I learned reporting the story is, you know, lots of people have overdoses on the job, but you can pick up and keep going. The man I profiled in my story, the construction worker who overdosed 3 times on a job before he was even fired. And each of those times, he actually went back to work right after he was revived. The first 2 times, someone on the job site gave him a dose of Narcan and he was able to get back up. And the 3rd time, he actually went to the hospital, was revived, and went back to work after that.
Which is stunning to imagine, really. And was there a particular sector of industry that seemed to be more impacted than another?
Well, I looked mostly at the construction industry, and sort of not surprisingly, that's an area where there is a lot of problem with opioids and with substance abuse overall. The opioid piece makes sense because a lot of workplace injuries happen on construction sites. That's an easy moment to get addicted. But the truth is, this is happening in all kinds of industries. I mean, think about the healthcare industry, for example, where this is also an issue. Doctors, nurses, other healthcare workers, they have very easy access to prescription pain pills, another easy way to get addicted. So I don't think it's limited to, you know, blue collar, white collar. I think this is happening really across the board.
And so you focus on in the story about employers' response to that. Of course, if people are overdosing in your, you know, in your workplace, you have to respond to that. So one would think, but it doesn't seem like that is always the case. As you're talking about this, you know, the man that you profiled who's overdosing three times before action was taken, things like that. Are there, you know, are employers trying to make effort to help employees out? Is it, you know, what is the response to this? It seems so, you know, it almost seems like one of those areas where the epidemic has grown so quickly that employers are perhaps scrambling to even know how to respond.
I think they're absolutely scrambling. It can be hard to identify unless you see a worker literally overdosing or nodding off on the job. I think it can be harder to spot. But what I found in the course of my reporting is, for the most part, employers are kind of turning a blind eye to this. I think opioid addiction is complicated, and it's a sticky, hairy, expensive, big issue. Employers are faced with a lot of things they need to deal with. And I think this is kind of going by the wayside. I think a lot also don't want to be associated with the idea that their workforce, there may be an opioid problem in their workforce. But I think it's obvious, especially in areas where there's just, that have been inundated with opioids, that this is a problem. And what I found was, you know, a lot of employers are saying, oh, this is not a problem in our workforce. But once their health insurance brokers come to them and show them the data that's coming up actually from their claims, from the insurance that they provide to their employees, it becomes fairly obvious that they actually do have an opioid problem. And whether or not they address it, you know, they're paying big for it. You know, between, I think, 2008 and 2016 or maybe 2004, the amount of money that employers are spending on opioids increased ninefold. That is a huge increase. This is a very expensive problem. In addition, workers who misuse pain medication, they miss, you know, almost three times as many days of work a year. They tend to come in late, be absent. I mean, this is a problem that employers are paying for, whether or not they're actually addressing it.
That's right. And so, as you're talking about the construction industry and, you know, areas where, you know, injuries are probably a lot more common than, say, working in an office, there's a lot of union involvement there. Are unions an interim step there to help mitigate this and help with substance abuse and addiction and address those issues?
That is absolutely what I found, that far and away, employers seem to be kind of turning a blind eye to this, not really addressing it head on. Unions, on the other hand, not all, but there's a significant movement to really deal with this. And that may have something to do with the fact that unions are, you know, supposed to sort of be this brotherhood idea. And they really are, some of them, dealing with it. For example, 14 building trade unions got together and decided to come up with ideas of how to work with this, how to help members, how to identify the substance abuse and then steer them into treatment and pay for it in a way that worked for the members. Again, the man I profiled in this story was a bricklayer in Portland. The International Bricklayers Union has a very strong program to get members help with their opioid addiction. And essentially, that's what saved this man, Jimmy Sullivan. His union president and others in the union in Portland really helped get him into treatment and keep him there. And it was hard, and it continues to be hard. You know, often opioid addiction isn't something that just gets treated and goes away. People may need multiple rounds of treatment and really sort of steady support. That's something that a union may be willing to provide, whereas an employer may be more hesitant.
Yeah, it is a really, it is a complicated story. And again, I'm going to be tweeting this out after the program because I want everyone to read it for themselves. And so, Jenny, what is what's on the horizon here? Like, is there an employer who's kind of modeling the ideal way, or are unions leading this way, or is it the workers themselves?
I think in general, unions are leading the way here. I think they're sort of a bright spot, but that doesn't mean that there aren't any employers that are trying to do good as well. For example, there's a company in Indiana called Belden, and they have started a very small pilot program. It's brand new, but they're actually funding treatment not only for current employees who may have a problem, but also for people applying for jobs. For that company, it's been very hard to find new workers, new skilled workers who aren't testing positive for drugs. So what they're doing is they made sense from a business perspective to actually pay on the front end for treatment to get those workers to be sober and then put them into the workforce. And they're doing that as well for workers who test positive who are already working for them. They're putting them through a program, then kind of easing them back into the company, perhaps in a job that may not have like a safety or accident potential, but then maybe moving them back after some period of time into their original job. So that's a company that really is sort of forward thinking. But I think those companies, at least from my reporting, are few and far between.
It certainly seems that way. Thank you so much, Jenny Gold, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, for joining us today. I appreciate you breaking this story down with us.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, plenty more to talk about. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. In 20 WGN, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Coming up here in a bit, we're going to be turning things over to Scott Catoon for the Startup Showcase. Always interesting stuff going on in that show. So, if you have been following the news, I'm sure that you have noticed that earlier this week, although maybe you didn't, because there's been a few other things going on in the news this week that perhaps allowed you to overlook this, but Dunkin' Donuts shed its last name. It's just Dunkin' now. Just Dunkin'. And a little bit earlier, Griffin, you were saying that you've called it that all along.
Yes, I was a real trendsetter, yes.
But now, like, it's taken away the cool cred because you were just that guy that called it Dunkin'. Now it's...
I was half kidding, but there was some novelty to it.
But deep down in your heart, you meant that.
That is lost now that it's the official name. Yeah, absolutely.
I totally agree with that. Well,
there's truth to every goof.
Oh, for a second, I thought you were... I thought I was like,
oh, Guth.
What'd you say about Guth? What? That took a minute.
I never even thought about that.
That's what I say when people go, how do you pronounce your last name? I say Guth like truth. That's what I always say. It works out in, mostly. So there are many companies, though, that have changed their name. Although I wouldn't say this is a change. This is just an abbreviation. Like, it's not like they went from Dunkin' Donuts to, like,
something
some totally other
entirely
word.
Entirely different.
Which companies have done. Do you know there is and there should be a word for this, but, like, there probably is, and I don't know it. A brand name that becomes a verb, like Xerox.
Right. Right, Kleenex.
Well, that's not a verb, but yeah.
Not a verb, no.
Xerox or say Google, for example.
Yeah.
Google used to be called Backrub. What? How is that possible that it was called Backrub? Yes. Back in 1996, it was called Backrub, which, they changed it just a couple of years later because they realized Backrub is a terrible name for a search engine.
Well,
I don't even know how you got that.
There's no explanation in that thing, is there?
Not even. No.
They're like, of course it was once called Backrub, but then they changed it. Like, wait, why did we start there?
Yeah, because that's the funniest one.
Everyone was just searching. It was a general search engine, but mostly people were looking for Backrubs back then.
I guess.
No,
right.
No.
Why did we? Why? Why was that the name? Here's one that definitely became more catchy. That is Quantum Computer Services. Not really rolling off the tongue, now better known as AOL.
Oh, okay.
Much better.
I guess so. What would Quantum Computer Services...
You know, Quantum's...
QCS, even that's kind of hard
even
to
that.
Say.
AOL. Just
because I was going to say AOL has the benefit of just being three letters, but QCS does not roll off the tongue either. AOL is like, it's very easy to say.
It's very easy. They also help themselves by putting... a CD-ROM in every single Dell computer throughout the 90s, right? And so that everybody had, I mean, I have a relative who may or may not be my mom who, until about a year ago, believed she would open a browser, type in AOL.com, log into her email, and she thought she was like logging into the internet.
Right, right.
Because she was like, AOL is the internet. That's how you get into it.
Well, there was a time where you'd do the, you know,
with the dial-up modem.
Yeah.
How did that go again, Griffin? That's right. Yup.
I could do the high pitched thing too if you want. You want me to try that?
That one.
Not even
that time we were super annoying and acting like dial up modems on the air. Also known as the day that I got fired. Here's one. Pepsi Cola. Guess what that used to be called? This is a major upgrade.
I don't know what.
I would have never, not that I drink soda now, but I would have never purchased this in my entire life. It was called Brad's Drink.
I love that. Terrible. That's great. But
imagine,
Brad's.
Think of Pepsi ads. Think of, like, if it was still called Brad's Drink, imagine, like, the.
I love that so much.
The Jenner child that walked up and handed the cop the Pepsi, right, in that ad that was so controversial.
Oh,
she
gosh,
handed
yeah.
him a Brad's Drink. That's ridiculous.
That's, I've been rewatching a couple episodes of Mad Men, the television series, as I'm known to do, unfortunately. It's,
sure.
It's a pretty common occurrence for me. In the last one that I watched, they were marketing a Pepsi product, and it was their first diet soda for women who want to reduce, is how it was put in the show.
Oh, my God.
And it was called Patio instead of Diet Pepsi. That sort of way of using terminology had not come about yet.
Women who want to reduce.
It was called Patio. I thought
somewhere
that was
in
so
the
funny.
Background, Guth is shrieking at her television. Ridiculous. Wow. Patio.
Good
one.
Yeah.
Still better than Brad's Drink.
A little better than Batman.
It was named after the North Carolina pharmacist, Caleb Bradham, who made that in the late.
It wasn't even a Brad.
He wasn't even a Brad. Yeah, Caleb. It wasn't even like Brad Jones. No, Caleb Bradham. He was
Caleb's would be even funnier.
Caleb's Drink. Yeah, ridiculous. Let's see. This one, I think, is very funny. Hertz Rent-A-Car used to be called Drive Yourself.
I like that. That's
but funny. It was spelled D-R-I-V-U-R-Self. Drive yeah. yourself. Which sounds a little like, hey, man, not my problem. Drive yourself.
You got it.
It's not like rent a car. Here's your car, your freedom. No, no, no. It's like, do it yourself, man.
Enjoy yourself.
Yeah. Nike used to be called Blue Ribbon Sports, which sounds, Nike, you know, that's mythology.
Right. Yeah, well, it has the benefit of that. And it's just a one word, catchy, and kind of means something else, but also is not well known enough that it can be supplanted in the popular imagination by your product. The
That's
same
right.
way Google is.
That's right.
And Google is now like a model for naming things. I feel like every tech thing for the next 15 years all wanted to name themselves something that would kind of roll off the tongue like Google. And it got to a point where it's kind of annoying.
Absolutely. There's like the trend of naming your web company a word that is misspelled, usually just like take out the vowels.
Right, right. Yeah.
With an R in the end, right? But I don't know. I think Nike's a good one.
Oh, Nike's great.
Yeah. Let's see. Starbucks used to be kind of a mouthful. Starbucks coffee, tea, and spices.
Oh, yeah. Well, they did the reduction the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, same. So they went the way of Dunkin'. So Dunkin', take heart. It went well for Starbucks. Also, I'm going to say IBM, way better than Computing Tabulating Recording Corporation.
I kind of respect these old tech companies, though, like back in the day when they didn't know how to do it.
That's right.
And there was no culture around it yet, exactly, except that they were just nerds.
And no one asked the receptionist how hard that would be to answer that phone. Hello, Computing Tabulating Recording Corporation. Especially if you were answering the phone for someone with a really complicated last name. Blah, 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 blah's office. Right. Then that's a mouthful. That's a sentence and a half.
They did not think about that.
Yeah. Well, so lots of rebrands have happened. PayPal was Confinity, which doesn't sound. PayPal's friendly. It's your pal that you pay. It's fine. So lots of interesting stuff and more. So we wish, I suppose, I'm sorry it's taken away the cool one word cred from you there, Griffin.
It's
but
okay.
I bet you're still going to go there. They still make extremely delicious coffee. Just remember, if you're in Rhode Island and you say you want your coffee regular, You're going to get stuff. You're going to get like cream and two sugars in it. That does not mean black coffee. And nor does it mean that you're going to get a size regular coffee. It means it's loaded up. Things I learn in Rhode Island. All right. Well, that does it for us. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.